Senate Tax Committee. It's my pleasure to call this hearing to order. The first item on our agenda is adoption of the minutes from January 19th. The minutes are in your members' packets. Are there any corrections? Seeing none, the minutes stand approved as presented. Today, our major activity and purpose is the confirmation hearing on the appointments of two persons to the Office of the Minnesota Tax Court Judge. We'll begin with Judge Bowman. Welcome to the committee, Judge Bowman. We are fairly informal in these hearings, but we certainly would like to hear from you, general description of your work and your background and anything that you think may be of interest to this committee as we consider your confirmation.
Thank you, Senator Rust. And good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to appear here today.
Excuse me, could you move the mic a little bit closer to you?
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to appear here in support of my confirmation as a judge to the Minnesota Tax Court. I'd like to recognize that I'm here today with my family, my wife, Erica, and my two children, Josh and Avery, are here today. I'm also joined remotely by my family, my parents and my sister, and my brothers even watching from Amman, Jordan. So this is a special day for me and my family. As you know, the Minnesota Tax Court is a three-judge court with statewide jurisdiction. We are an independent agency of the executive branch where we hear taxpayer appeals of property assessments, and we also hear taxpayer appeals from orders of the Commissioner of Revenue. I began my career in this building nearly 20 years ago when I was hired as a legislative assistant for the Minnesota State Senate, shortly after I graduated from McAllister College. While serving here full-time as an LA, I attended William Mitchell College of Law's part-time night program, earning my JD. My legal career has been entirely in public service. First, I served as an attorney for what is now the Housing Justice Center, where I represented homeowners in foreclosure after the Great Recession. Next, I served as an assistant Hennepin County attorney in the Civil Division, representing assessors in tax court. It was with this background and experience guiding property tax disputes through the tax court that I was appointed to serve as a judge 3 years ago, serving as chief for the last 9 months. In that time, I have consistently ensured that my decisions fairly apply the law to the facts in front of me. My decisions show that I listen to the arguments each litigant makes and write opinions that lawyers and lay people can understand. At the start of the pandemic, like most organizations, we put our cases on pause. When it was clear the pandemic would be with us for a while, we were able to quickly pivot to remote hearings and trials. It didn't take us long to get caught up with our docket, and we remain so today. Again, thank you for considering my confirmation. It has been a privilege to serve the people of Minnesota, and I look forward to continuing in this role, doing my part to ensure fair taxation and transparent taxation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excuse me. Thank you. Judge Bowman, are there questions or comments? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome to the committee, Judge, and thank you for being here this morning. I recognize that most of the appeals in tax court are property tax appeals, and I guess my question is, roughly, what percentage of property owners typically prevail, and has that percentage changed in the years that you've been on the court?
Madam Chair and
Judge Bowman.
Madam Chair and Senator Weber, thank you for the question. So the question is how many taxpayers prevail generally? Mm-hmm. So you are correct. Most of our docket are property tax appeals. We have about 3,000 appeals a year, and the vast majority of them are property tax appeals. Most of them settle, like most courts, about 99% of cases settle. Those that do go to trial, I don't know statistically what the answer is, but I would say roughly half. Keep in mind that in tax court with property tax appeals, when a litigant or when a taxpayer is appealing the value of their property, it's not usually a winner or a loser. So, for example, a taxpayer may have a property that's assessed at $1 million. The taxpayer thinks it's worth $500,000, and the county defends the assessment and argues that it's worth $1.5 million, just by way of an example. The tax court may land anywhere in that range and has the authority to land outside the range if the facts and the evidence warrants it. So usually it's somewhere in the range of the numbers presented by the parties.
Senator Romney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a real estate appraiser, and I have testified in tax court before, and that's why I'm asking the question. And I also recognize that assessors are, there's a prescribed method or prescribed format for them to follow. Their sales study ends at a date specific and sometimes isn't always 100% current with the market because that closing date is a few months prior to the actual date of value. And I think about, for example, the situation we had in the Enbridge line whereby values were appealed and over a number of times values were found in favor of the taxpayer. And so I was just curious if you're seeing a trend where we were having greater number of cases that favor the taxpayer or not. I recognize usually by the time they get in front of you, I would assume that there are professional appraisers on both sides of the issue at that point. Would that be correct?
Judge Bowman?
Madam Chair and Senator Weber, yes.
Yeah.
By the time a case arrives in front of it, it generally has an expert by way of a certified appraiser
right.
Testifying to the value.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Senator Nelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, and welcome to the Tax Committee. My question has to do with timing. What's the tip? I mean, we know there's not really anything typical, but what's the typical time that it takes for an appeal to get to trial? How long is the taxpayer kind of in limbo?
Judge Bowman.
Senator Rust, Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, generally about 18 months. When a tax appeal is filed, and usually the bulk of them are filed by April 30th because that's the deadline, we start issuing scheduling orders shortly thereafter, and it has an 18-month timeline. As I mentioned before, the vast majority of cases, 99% of them, settle before trial. So we're only talking about a few that come through at that mark. The exception to that would be small claims cases. Mm-hmm. Small claims cases are filed. They're a smaller subsection of cases, so generally the value has to be lower. The claims have to be less complicated generally. And then we issue scheduling orders on a faster track because that's the purpose of small claims is to get a decision more quickly.
Madam Chair?
Senator Nelson?
Just a couple follow-ups. So why does it seems like 18 months, a year and a half is a long time for an appeal to get to trial. And I think you said that very few of them get to that point. So my question is, why is it taking 18 months for a taxpayer's appeal to get to the court?
Judge Bowman.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, it's in the court when it's filed, and the parties generally engage. If it goes to trial, The parties are generally engaging in possibly a significant amount of pretrial activity, such as discovery or maybe even motion practice, and all of that takes time. If parties are so inclined to move their case along faster, parties have in the past requested that, and we have always been amenable to moving schedules up. We rarely get those requests, but I can't see why we would not grant that.
Madam Chair, just to kind of get a little bit more closure on this. So when a taxpayer files an appeal, then it takes 18 months to get to your bench. It takes 18 months to get before the judge. And I just want to make sure, first of all, that I'm understanding right. Then I have a follow-up question.
Judge Bowman.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, most likely not. And the reason would be the parties are probably engaging in some sort of pretrial activity. So if there's motion practice, they're in front of the judge. If there's a discovery dispute, they're in front of the judge. If they choose not to bring the issues to the court, then they would not be in front of a judge.
So then...
Senator Nelson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So maybe I phrased my question wrong. So when they file a suit, how long does it take to get action by the court? So if I had... an appeal right now, a tax court appeal of any kind, not just property tax, and I filed an appeal today, how long would it be before the process of negotiating, being before the court would start taking place? That's maybe, I just want to be clear on that.
Judge Bowman.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, so I'm going to answer your question in two parts. If today you filed an appeal.
Sales tax, for example, they're often confusing.
Challenging an order from the Commissioner of Revenue dealing with sales tax. You would file your appeal, and within a couple of weeks, the court would have the parties contact the court to set a scheduling order, which is very typical not only in tax court, but in other courts, state and federal courts. And in that case, the parties would almost certainly agree on deadlines for pretrial activity as well as trial, and then the case would be set in motion. Since we have so many, the second part of your question, since we have so many property tax appeals, we generally wait until after the deadline, the April 30th yearly deadline, and then we send out scheduling orders in batches so that counties and taxpayers get their scheduling orders spread out over several months from the past year's property taxes. And so that is generally how we are sending out our scheduling orders.
Thank you. Final question, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
And thank you for explaining that process a little bit. For those of us who have not been to tax court, it's important to understand that, or maybe been to any court. So then how long does it take to deliver a decision? So once our taxpayer has gone through filing the appeal, working with the tax court, the other attorneys, then, and they've finished their, whatever that regiment of things is that they would be doing to try to settle or not, and they've thrown in the towel or whatever and said, this is, judge, this is up to you. How long does it take for them to get a decision, typically?
Judge Bowman.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, we have a statutory 3-month deadline after the last court action. So if we are deciding something immediately after trial, we have 3 months from the date of trial. If parties elect to submit post-trial briefs, which most do because tax court trials are incredibly fact-intensive, and it's a wonderful opportunity for the parties to synthesize the facts and present them to the court in a way that's easier to understand what the party's arguments are 3 months after the last brief is submitted. And that 3-month deadline is also the statutory deadline that is given to state district courts.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have more questions, but I'll wait and let other members speak before I, if there are others.
Thank you, Senator Nelson.
Yes.
Senator Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Judge Bowman. So, Judge, One of the things that I wonder, you've been in the tax court now or as a judge for 2 years. What are the things that you think about as you reflect back on your experience there and you think, you know, maybe this part of property tax law needs to be clarified to provide more transparency, make it easier for taxpayers? Are there any areas that through your experience you would want to let us know that maybe we need to take a better look at?
Judge Bowman.
Madam Chair and Senator Drazkowski, thank you for that question. This is an area, I've been a judge for 3 years and I practiced in the area for 8 years before that. The first thing that comes to mind is a bill that's actually been introduced this year. I would invite the members to take a look at a bill that changes the way a litigant can file a property tax case. And to be clear, I am not taking a position on the bill. I think that is better left to the parties who would be impacted by it. But right now, as the way the statute is written, if you want to file a property tax petition, you have to file 4 copies in 4 different offices. Now, there's an exception where some offices can streamline that, and most do for obvious reasons. It's much easier. But the bill would change the process, and I believe the idea is to make it easier for taxpayers to file their property tax petitions, which is important because filing properly, timely filing your property tax petition in the right office is a prerequisite to getting in court. And if you don't do it correctly, oftentimes the county will bring a motion to dismiss for failure, for lack of jurisdiction, and the court is required in certain circumstances to grant that motion, and then a taxpayer is out of court, right? And so we don't even get to make the decision on the merits. So I would give a heads up to that bill. And again, I'm not taking a position, but it's something that I think could help litigants if done properly.
Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It seemed
to
me that
thank you, Judge.
That bill wouldn't come to the Tax Committee, however. It would go to the Judiciary Committee, wouldn't you think? Yeah, I'm not sure it would come, that it would come before the Tax Committee, although we have seen some bills this session that get, in my mind, improperly directed, and so we end up making a number of motions on the floor to get bills into the right committee. And I don't know that came about so much from perhaps not understanding exactly what the jurisdictions of a particular committee are. We have found, when I say we, anybody listening to the bill introductions can tell, since we make so many changes, that something is not working as smoothly as we would like it to. So, but thank you for your comment, Judge Bowman. Back to Senator Nelson, unless Senator Drazkowski. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Judge, thank you for kind of walking through some of these things. And I have an assumption that I assume that most of these disputes are between the taxpayer and an entity of government that is due those taxes. And I'm still kind of thinking about this timeline that, you know, a year and a half is a long time. And also then 3 months after that year and a half for a decision, and yet most of the cases are settled. So why does it take so, why is there another 3 months to render the decision after all the facts have been in, there's been a year and a half of negotiations? So why is it another 3 months?
Judge Bowman.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, It's not always 3 months. That's the deadline. They have to be in by 3 months. Oftentimes, we craft orders and send them out when they're ready, which is well in advance of the 3 months. It is true, however, that orders and decisions from the tax court do take the three-month statutory timeline. And the reason for that is because oftentimes we have large, high-dollar properties that need to be valued, and I'm sure Senator Weber can attest to the fact that it's not always easy to value those properties. We digest the opinions from the experts on both sides, which are usually wildly divergent, often differing in millions of dollars. And then there's careful study of the law to ensure that we are getting the burdens and the standards correct when litigants present evidence to us. Drafting, we send our opinions around for circulation to get opinions from other judges. We also send the opinions to our clerks, our law clerks, who also do research on them, and rigorously site check them to make sure that they're accurate, so that when we send out a work product, it's high quality, which takes 3 months.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I appreciate the focus on quality. I'm just left thinking that the average Minnesotan, it sounds like they might not have that access as much to the tax court, only because it takes over a year and a half. And so I'm just somewhat concerned about that. I'm hoping that we can, if there's things that we need to clarify in our laws to make it so that there are fewer, I realize there's only 3,000 cases, I think, but still, that's 3,000 Minnesotans that are kind of on hold for a year and a half as they try and work through this. And I'm not sure who would bring those to us, but as we see, as we note things that are not clear, I hope there's a way that we have access to be aware of those statutes that maybe we need to tighten up a bit or make a little more clear.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. And Judge Bowman, the bill, I think that you are, or the proposal that you are, that you referred to is Senate File 580, and it's authored by Senator Lemmer in the Senate. So I guess it is coming to the Tax Committee instead of Judiciary. We'll see whether they want to see it as well. Are there any other questions or comments? Well, Judge Bowman, you come highly recommended, and you have a wonderful resume, and we appreciate the work that you are doing for the people of Minnesota. And I believe Senator Klein has a motion. Excuse me, Senator Dibble first.
My apologies for stepping on your final comments.
It's okay.
Didn't jump quite quickly enough, but I'm happy to also support Judge Bowman, whom I recall from her time serving in public service in the Senate, and whom I've known as a friend and member of the community, and can tell you that she has a big heart for public service and for serving people and doing well by our larger community in the state of Minnesota, as her record evidences and as her time in service evidences. And she's been, I know people who know her as a tax judge, other attorneys who they also tell me that she has a very, very good reputation as a lawyer and as an attorney as well. So I'm happy to vote in favor of her confirmation.
Senator Dibble, I'm going to change my decision there and ask you to make.
Well, thank you. That's an honor. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Madam Chair, I move to recommend that the appointment of Jane N. Bowman as judge on the Minnesota Tax Court be confirmed and sent to the Senate floor.
Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails. And your confirmation will be sent, recommendation will be sent to the Senate floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
We have another confirmation to consider, and that is of Wendy Tian, and we'll ask her to come forward now. There are three that will be before us. The third appointment wasn't able to join us today, and we will come back to her. What's her name?
Madam Chair, it's Judge De La Peña.
De La Peña, okay. We'll take up her confirmation at another time. Judge Tan, welcome to the committee equally, and we had chatted a little bit before the committee, and I wonder if you could just say a few things about yourself, and then we'll open it up to the members for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for having me today. It's an honor and a privilege to be appearing in front of you, and I'm looking forward to answering any questions that you have for me. Before I make myself available for those questions, just a brief introduction. I am originally from the Milwaukee suburbs, so neighbor to the east, but I came to Minnesota for law school in 1990, and since then, despite having left town a couple of times, I moved back here in 2016 after about 16 years at the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., to work for the Office of the Minnesota Attorney General, first under A.G. Lori Swanson, and then subsequently under A.G. Keith Ellison. While there, I was a line attorney in the tax division of the AG's office, and subsequently in 2019 became manager of the tax division. During my time as tax division manager, I was appointed to the court where I now sit, and it's, again, my pleasure to answer any questions you have for me about my background or my work on the court. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judge. Questions for Judge Tan? Senator Weber, let's start with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, Judge. And I think you heard my question to Judge Bowman, and I guess don't expect you to go through all of that again, but do you see any difference in the awards as far as the, you know, favoring the plaintiff or the taxpayer or the state that would reflect maybe problems that exist within the system?
Judge Tan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Weber. Thank you for your question. Speaking for myself, I don't think there, I tried to recall before I came here today whether there was a way for me to look through some sort of electronic, we maintain an electronic database, and this is how people file cases and how we manage them. And I was trying to find out whether there was an easy way, since I've heard so many cases, to gauge the split between the two, taxpayers and government entities. And as Judge Bowman noted, there's not a simple answer to that question because, for example, in a property tax case, the taxpayer may seek a very specific valuation of their property, and the county, or in some cases the Commissioner of Revenue, might have a very different determination of their value based on an initial assessment or on an appraisal, such as one done by yourself, during litigation. At trial, however, the answer is not usually that clear cut. Property tax cases specifically, the court would hear evidence and testimony from both parties, and then, assuming that the burden of proof, the initial burden of persuasion, I should say, had been overcome, there's a statutory burden that the taxpayer has to overcome, which is that an assessment or another order of a government entity has presumptive validity. So assuming that initial burden has been overcome, the court has to reach a determination of value. And in doing so, the court may reach a determination of value that's more or less than what either party seeks. So oftentimes, the decision is somewhere in the middle. So to that extent, the taxpayer may not feel they'd been fully successful, but they also would have received a reduction in value from what the assessment was. So it's hard to say whether that decision favors the taxpayer or favors the government entity. I hope I'm making myself clear. Mm-hmm. In In very few cases in tax court, at least in my experience, does the court render a valuation decision exactly as sought by the county or is exactly as sought by the taxpayer. It's usually somewhere in between, and only on appeal or post-trial motions do we learn whether a valuation that was lower than that sought by the county but higher than that sought by the taxpayer is ultimately satisfactory to those parties.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. most of us, unlike Senator Weber, are not all that familiar with the path that an issue takes through the tax court. But so here's my question. So what if either party is dissatisfied and does not want to accept the ruling or the determination by the tax court judge, what is open to them as a next step?
Thank you for your question, Madam Chair. A losing party has a statutory right of appeal directly to the Supreme Court, the Minnesota Supreme Court. And that is an appeal as of right. It's not the typical way that a district court appeal would be made. It's not by a, it's not a discretionary appeal. It is an appeal as of right. So to the extent that a losing party seeks review of a decision of the Minnesota Tax Court, their review would be conducted by the Minnesota Supreme Court.
So it doesn't go to, Judge Sheehan, doesn't go to a district court, it doesn't go to the Court of Appeals, it goes right to the Supreme Court.
Madam Chair, that's correct. It goes right to the Minnesota Supreme Court. It does not go through the district court or the Court of Appeals.
How many instances in the last, since you've started serving, have tax court decisions, regardless of who the judge was, have they been taken to the Supreme Court?
Madam Chair, thank you. I was trying to think of that before I came here as well, and I'm aware, for my part, of three decisions that have been appealed to the Minnesota Supreme Court, two of which have already been decided, one of which is pending. With respect to the court as a whole, as a rough estimate, I would say a dozen. It seems like about a dozen, in my recollection, just going through the cases I can remember, have been appealed since my time on the court.
And after the Minnesota Supreme Court, can they go to the federal court?
Madam Chair, no. Federal court is not an option for direct appeal from decisions of the tax court, which are then appealed to the Supreme Court.
So once the decision, a decision has been rendered by the Minnesota Supreme Court, that is final?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The Minnesota Supreme Court is the court of last resort regarding state tax issues in Minnesota.
Any other questions? I have always good. Senator Raskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Judge Dean. Same question for you, Judge. As you think about your experience, are there any areas of property tax law that if you were in our shoes, you would train your eyes on to try to make it easier or more transparent or fairer to Minnesota taxpayers?
Madam Chair, Senator Drazowski, thank you for your
Judge
question. I also call your attention to the pending litigation, which I would characterize as an effort to simplify and modernize service of process on the counties when a property tax appeal is undertaken. That's one of two that I'd like to mention, but that's the first one. As there's a bill currently pending, I think it's appropriate to mention it. I will note by way of history that during the pandemic, I think the pandemic made things difficult on a lot of people. Before the start of the pandemic, individuals and entities represented by counsel, for the most part, were able to obtain answers from counties, county assessor's offices, and the like concerning how to go about filing a tax court appeal from a property tax order. During the pandemic, which set in just before the April 30th filing deadline in 2020 for 2019 cases, a lot of government offices closed, and that process was thrown into disarray. And I personally heard a number of cases in which an individual taxpayer, not so much business entities, I had a few of those, but they were mostly individual taxpayers representing themselves, did not know how to effectuate service of process on the four government officials, the four county officials listed in the current statute. Because of that, counties moved for dismissal, sometimes on the basis of lack of jurisdiction, sometimes on the basis of failure of service of process. And in some of those cases, their cases were dismissed because it was evident that the taxpayer was not able to meet the service requirements of the statute. So from my standpoint, although I won't speak directly to any of the specific content of the proposed legislation, I think it is important that the service of process system, the service of process system set forth in the statute, which is Minnesota Statute Section 278.01, be clarified, because especially with respect to people who don't appear regularly in our court and aren't familiar with the process of service of process and filing a case, it's important that for them to obtain maximum access to this court and redress of their disputes, they have a clear understanding of how to effectuate service, how to file a case, and it's also important that those processes not be unnecessarily complicated. So that's one thing. That's the service of process statute that we've all heard about. The other thing I want to say is I think there are complexities in the Minnesota Data Practices Act, Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, that make it difficult for litigants to understand their rights and for counties or other government agencies to fulfill their responsibilities regarding data privacy. When it comes to litigation in the tax court, there have been a number of cases in which a conflict concerning, you know, private data and the rights of parties to discovery have made themselves apparent, the most recent of which to reach an appellate body, I apologize if I get the exact title wrong, is G&I OIX Oracle LLC versus County of Hennepin. In that case, the question of obligations of the county versus the rights of the parties to discovery were forefront. And speaking candidly, there are still questions after that opinion of the Supreme Court. There's still questions about how data should be handled in tax court litigation. So I think it's important that it's preferable that the legislature address those issues. Certainly, those issues have been addressed several times by the tax court and on occasion by the Minnesota Supreme Court, but it's legislation, so an optimal solution is for the legislation clearly to reflect what those rights and responsibilities should be. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Skalski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Judge Keene. I tried to keep up with what you were saying there, but so the taxpayers in that case, because of their lack of understanding of the data practices and rights, are...
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Senator Putnam. So the taxpayers in that case appear to be or may be placed at a disadvantage because of their lack of understanding of their data practices rights, and the counties may have an advantage in understanding that, and because of that, we need to somehow make clarity. That's what I gathered. Can you help understand that kind of nugget of the whole thing better?
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you. And I take your point. It's a lot. There was a lot of complexity, and I think that's one of the points of my raising this data practices issue, because although I'm loath to take the side of one party or another in characterizing how the rights of the parties are affected, I would say that, yes, in that case in particular, a large corporate entity represented by counsel believed that it was placed at a substantial disadvantage regarding its discovery, its expert witness report, and ultimately the case it was able to present to the court because of an ambiguity, let's call it, between the Data Practices Act and the existing discovery obligations under the part of the Minnesota statutes that relates to property tax cases. That's section 278.05, subdivision 3, to be specific. And there are a number of provisions of the Data Practices Act that are implied by tax court litigation. So, yes, in short, the taxpayer did believe it had been substantially disadvantaged, and you know, whether or not that was actually the case, it led to an ongoing, longstanding conflict between the parties. I know that Senator Nelson had asked questions earlier about the amount of time it takes for cases to work their way through the tax court, and one factor can be not only lengthy discovery, but disputes about what's required in discovery, and that is the sort of dispute that has led to extended motion practice relating to discovery before the tax court that can drag out a tax court appeal. And I think, as we all know, the further from the event in question the parties actually wind up in court, the less they remember, the more mistakes they make in their memory, and the more, in other words, inaccurate the court's body of knowledge is when reaching a fact-finding in a case. Thank you, Senator.
Senator Drazkowski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Judge Klein. Tien. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Klein.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Judge Tien. Thank you for coming before the committee and for those fulsome answers to our questions. A little bit over the head, I'm afraid, of somebody without legal background in my case, but I'm very grateful for them. I want to just say, as reading your application, it appears that you were appointed and your confirmation request sent to the Senate in late 2019. Is that right? And then you've been serving for 3 years without a hearing such as this. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Klein, yes, that's correct. I have been serving since November 2019.
And during that time, the people of Minnesota haven't had the benefit of sort of hearing the answers that you've provided today or learning about your judicial preferences or you know, your outlook on the work, so forth, et cetera.
Judge Tien.
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you. Yes, that's true. Information about my life background, my academic background, my work history is available on our website. There is a public biography published of each of the three judges, and it provides that kind of information, but certainly not the information that I'm testifying to today.
Thank you, Senator Klein. Judge Tien, the size of the tax court, how many judges are there? Some of us don't know that.
Madam Chair, there are three judges of the Minnesota Tax Court.
It's the three of you now. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge, just a question. I'm not exactly sure if it's in your jurisdiction, but you can probably give the best, maybe some insight on this. One of the things that I've had a couple constituents actually bring to my attention, as well as other legislators, apparently, I'm not sure which county it is up here, maybe Hennepin County, Ramsey, it was a property tax case where the property owner was unable to pay their property taxes. And I'm assuming it went through tax court, although I don't know, but the end result is that the county then confiscated or took that property because the owner was unable to pay their due property taxes, the property taxes due, but then they sold it for a profit, but the county kept the profit. So it just doesn't seem right that someone who can't afford their property taxes gets their property confiscated could be a better word, by the property taxing entity, and then they turn around and sell it and make a profit. It seems like the profit from that forced sale should go to the former owner of that property. Are you aware of that case?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, thank you.
I
am aware of the existence of that case, but that case did not pass through the Minnesota Tax Court and wasn't decided by the tax court. But if I can just briefly address the issue of property confiscation, as I believe you called it. So a jurisdictional prerequisite in the tax court for property tax cases is the payment of most of the property taxes. To the extent that there is, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the statute and its exact provisions, but there is a requirement to pay a portion of the taxes if the tax assessment is under dispute. And that's a statutory requirement. It's not a requirement of the court. The court's job is to uphold the law, but part of upholding the law is to administer the statute as clearly written. Now, in some cases, if the inability to make a property tax payment where the taxpayer disputes the valuation of the property or the classification of the property exists, I do think that is an impediment to obtaining access to justice at the tax court. But unfortunately, it's not an impediment that the court can overcome because it's a statutory prerequisite. As to the sale of the property by the county, say at a tax forfeiture or something like that, and the retention of those, I really can't speak to that because that's not something that's within the tax court's jurisdiction. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you've told me two things. You've told us two things that I think are help shed some light on this. What was the point? If you just go over that again, why is it that this particular property tax holder dispute did not come to your court? There was a reason. I think you gave the statute reason. Is it because they didn't pay any property taxes that suddenly they no longer had access to our state tax court? What was the reason that you mentioned that is in statute that really prevented this landowner or this property owner from coming to your court?
Madam Chair, Judge Senator Nelson, thank you. I want to be cautious here because I do not know the particulars respecting the taxpayer involved in that case.
Correct.
So I don't know why they didn't. Simple answer to your question is they didn't file a tax court appeal. For an entity, at least I don't believe so. Nothing about my familiarity with that matter suggests that they filed a tax court appeal. For the tax court to have jurisdiction over a dispute, the taxpayer has to file an appeal.
Sure.
And I'm only speculating as to the reasons why a taxpayer, not necessarily that taxpayer,
correct,
might have decided that they couldn't file a tax court appeal. Sometimes people don't. I'll just give you a simple example. I recently heard a case, I won't name it because it's still pending, in which there were multiple undivided interests in a certain piece of property, say a condominium. And taxes were assessed on that entire condominium, but only a couple of the undivided interest holders appealed from it. So does that mean that the other interest holders agreed? Does it mean that they just missed the deadline for filing and realized that it was too late to file an appeal? It's impossible to know. So there are cases in which inability to pay the taxes is not the issue. It could be any other issue. It could be because somebody just didn't meet the deadline. It could be because they decided that the cost of litigation was in excess of what would make tax court litigation worthwhile. It could be any of a number of reasons. I'm just noting that the existence of a statute that requires the payment of most of the property taxes could potentially serve as a deterrent.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Just to close this segment, thank you. This sheds some light on this. I have to say I'm still left wondering, and we'll look into what the remedy is. It does not seem that a property should be confiscated, sold at a profit, and the profit not shared, given to the county or whatever entity. So there's two questions that I guess I'll be working on, which is one, why is it that the tax, did they know there was a tax, an appeal process? And there could be all kinds of reasons why one would not choose to go through the appeal, as you've said. But then secondly, why is the, you know, about the profits and where do those go? So something to work on, which is outside this committee, but thank you very much for helping just shed some insight on what could or could not be particular in this case. Thank you.
Well, Senator Nelson, just as a comment on that, in public reasonings that have been offered by the county, once the property was forfeited, the former owner had no equity in the property whatsoever. So they no longer are a stakeholder in that property, and that's why the funds were returned up on the sale of the property were returned to the county, because the former taxpayer had no legal interest in the property anymore. It was out of their hands. That's the argument that at least I've read publicly in the newspaper that the county's been offering before the Supreme Court. I wonder, aside from that, the avenue that a property or an entity of whatever kind chooses to deal with an issue of property taxes, it's not forced on them where they can go. I mean, they could go to a district court. Is that correct? I mean, they're not forced to go to tax court, and if they don't go there, there is no other avenue. They can go a district court route or a federal court route. Is that correct? What are the ways in which someone can dispute a decision made by a county assessor, for example?
Madam Chair, thank you for your question. You are correct that the tax court is not the only forum for a taxpayer to seek resolution of their tax issues. The district court also is available by statute. The taxpayer may seek redress either in the tax court or may file a petition in district court. I should note, however, that the district court has sole discretion to decide whether to transfer such a petition filed in the district court to the tax court. It's not a decision the tax court makes. If a case is filed in the district court, that case may, at the discretion of the district court, be transferred to tax court.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there further things in this? You're having a conversation with us, and Judge Bowman is very enlightening, and I really do appreciate it on behalf of the committee. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. I notice you've been involved with the mock trial program, and I just want to thank you for that. The mock trial program in high school was probably the clinching decision for my daughter to enter the legal profession, and so she enjoyed that immensely. So just wanted to say thank you.
Oh, Madam Chair, Senator Weber, thank you very much for your comments. I actually really enjoy presiding over mock trial cases. It's incredible to see the amount of effort and, in some cases, real polish that high school students are capable of providing, and almost universally, the performances these students put on could be something of a learning experience for practicing lawyers who could see how it should be done. Really, it's really great. What school did your daughter go to?
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. She graduated from the Laverne High School. This is 25 years ago that she graduated from high school. So.
Wonderful. Well, it's great to hear that. Thank you.
Again, thank you Thank you very much. It's really interesting to hear from both of you about the workings of the tax court and just how experienced and thoughtful you all are with regard to these issues. What would you say, in your experience on the tax court, has been the most interesting set of facts about a dispute that's been presented, either to you or to one of your fellow judges?
Madam Chair, thank you for your question. The most interesting, it's hard to answer that question, although I will provide an answer because okay. So many, one of the things I really like about tax court, and I think it's not obvious to people who don't practice before the court, is it's not really about the taxes. Ultimately, the court has to reach a determination what the correct tax should be. But the disputes aren't really about taxes. They're about some other aspect of the life of an individual or about the life cycle of a business, right? For example, in the case of an individual, it's really about what they believe their property attributes to be. And you hear a lot from individuals about their homes, their history of moving into their home, improvements, that sort of thing. And in corporate property tax cases or in commissioner cases, you get a chance to learn so much about the operations of businesses that you never would otherwise have a chance to encounter. Hotels, restaurants, and the like. It's really, really fascinating. Actually, when I was, this is before I joined the court, but when I was an assistant attorney general at the AG's office, I was attorney of record for the commissioner in a case opposite the holding company for GoDaddy, the giant, you know, web provider, and I got to depose that guy. So that was really, it was really interesting. But going back to this, to your question, the most interesting fact scenario I think I've heard yet involved a case I just heard a couple of weeks ago. It was a case that was filed quite some time ago and took a long time to get to trial, primarily because the taxpayer didn't take any action for several years. And when I joined the court, I filed an order to show cause why I shouldn't dismiss it. And the parties both wanted to be heard, so we ultimately set it for trial. After a few COVID-related delays, got to trial and involved the exempt status of the property owned by a small church in not in the metro area. And there were a lot of just fascinating arguments why these numerous parcels of property should be or should not be exempt from tax. He called himself the president, but he was really the pastor of this church, provided almost 2 days of testimony. And it's something that I had no prior familiarity with other than, you know, being on the other litigation side, and hearing it as a judge was really, really interesting.
Thank you. I think one of the most interesting situations that have that was ever brought to the attention of the legislature involved a dispute between the county and a taxpayer where the county assessed the property as having value and wanted to have the taxes collected on it. And the business owner had polluted the property for a number of years and said they didn't owe any tax because it was worthless. And that seemed to me to be the height of irony, almost like someone who kills one parent and comes before the court for mercy because he or she is an orphan. And that, as I recall, was not in tax court, but elsewhere. And they found for the county, as I recall. But I found that the destroyer of the property was wanting to get out of paying taxes on it because they had rendered it worthless and wasn't worth anything to anybody. So, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question for Judge Tien, but more along these lines. These executive branch judges and courts are curious to me. I just don't know the history of them and how they came about. You know, we have the these executive branch courts. I just don't know the history of them and how they came about. The Office of Administrative Hearings, the Tax Court. I think there are others as well. And at some point, I'd be curious to know how they came about and why we have effectively functioning of the judicial branch embedded within the executive.
Sounds like, Senator Dibble, sounds like a good project for an intern.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
We'll see, maybe one of them would be interested in pursuing that. Are there any other questions or comments of Judge Tien? This time again, I will call on Senator Klein. And thank you so much, yourself and Judge Bowen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I echo the Chair's comments, Judge, about how this question and answer has been enlightening. Certainly very helpful. Thanks so much. And Madam Chair, I do move to recommend that the appointment of Wendy S. Tien as judge on the Minnesota Tax Court be confirmed and sent to the Senate floor.
You've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, say no. The motion prevails. Congratulations. Congratulations to both of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
We still have, as I indicated earlier, one more judge to hear from, and we will let the members know at some point. Probably won't take a whole hearing, but be part of a hearing going forward. So there being, well, wait a minute. We are not meeting tomorrow or Thursday, except in some instances with some members informally to start pursuing that area under our jurisdiction that deals with tax increment financing that Senator Weber and Senator Klein are working on, and the local sales taxes, which Senator Housechild and Senator Nelson are working on. And at some point over these next 2 days, I would really appreciate having a conversation with you about how you're going to work with Senate Counsel and go forward with that. We are running up against a deadline, of course, for the local sales taxes, and also there's no deadline on the TIF provisions, but we're hoping that the House will introduce and take up the state auditor's bill so that the TIF projects and proposals that come before us can be measured against a new law. So I'm hoping for those conversations to go forward. And if you have any questions about it, please come and see me for a conversation. It appears that the governor will be revealing his budget today and doing his full budget. He's been doing it in piecemeal, as we know, and later today, and we will, as soon as we get the tax portion of it introduced or presented to us as in language, not just ideas, we will start taking up parts of that. We have members who have undoubtedly will have had bills introduced that deal with some of the same issues and that will be within his bills. So I think they're going to be familiar to us, and I look forward after February 1st to dealing with them in committee. as well as other bills that don't have, that don't usually show up in a governor's budget, but that are nevertheless important to members. So that's how we're going to proceed, at least the general plan, the details to be filled in. Any questions about that? Okay, there being no further business before the committee, we're adjourned.